Welcome to For the Love of Conversation, the podcast that grew out of 3 Minute Storyteller, where we believe conversations connect us and social change begins with the stories we tell. At 3 Minute Storyteller, we share digital stories, video snippets of intimate, messy, expansive conversations with a wildly eclectic bunch of artists, scientists, leaders of all stripes, all who are legendary change agents. Some you may know, and hopefully many you don't. This podcast is the opportunity to bring you into the full conversation. I'm Shannon Mannon, along with my husband Mike and our VW bus Scarlett, who we've outfitted into an awesome mobile storytelling unit. We invite you into the full conversation with us. We're so glad you're along for the ride. When Mike and I headed up to the Viscardi Center and School on Long Island, New York, to interview its president and CEO and this week's storyteller, John Kemp, we got the chance to take a tour of the school. This school serves children with severe physical disabilities who are unable to attend public school due to their medical needs. Walking through the hallways, we were so excited to get to meet some of the students, some of whom had language disabilities that made talking a challenge, but it didn't stop them from chatting us up about their weekend plans or filling us in on stories about their friends and classmates. Some moved their electric scooters with head motions because they didn't have use of their hands. We even got to watch a pretty cutthroat wheelchair floor hockey game where they had adhered hockey sticks to the scooters. We got to visit an art class where students were putting finishing touches on beautiful Valentine's Day crafts. The teachers and nurses at Viscardi were kind enough to take a moment and show us some of the incredible accommodations that allowed their students to fully participate in school life. These kids join clubs, they have sleepovers on campus and plan weekend outings, they play sports, play music, and just enjoy their friends. Plus, of course, they take their academic classes. I've never seen a bunch of kids look so happy to be in school. It was like they were having the time of their lives. So at the end of the tour, we were setting up to begin our conversation with John in a conference room. And I noticed an unusual sensation in my body. I was calm. It was this like deep, relaxed calmness. And what's so weird about that is usually when I'm in a new place and I'm meeting tons of people and I'm about to start an interview, I'm usually like kind of jacked up, nervous, maybe slightly anxious about how it's going to go or how I'll be received. But being at the Viscardi School, I was penetrated with this feeling of total acceptance. It was a feeling I realized of my guard being completely down. And the funny thing is, I didn't even realize that I usually have a layer of armor on until I felt the sensation of what it was like to have it come off. Somehow, I think, because these kids were so fully themselves, on the subconscious level, it penetrated me and it allowed me to be more fully myself. It was a totally unexpected gift. And it set the stage perfectly for being in the presence of John Kemp. I'm so excited to share this man with you and his incredibly inspirational story. We were introduced to John by our friends at Encore.org, and they never steer us wrong. When they told us about John, who was born without arms and legs, and his legacy, his incredible legacy as a mentor and a leader and an advocate for the disability rights movement, we knew we had to meet him ourselves. And we're thrilled to be able to share his story with you. So John, I'd like to start back in your childhood a little bit. What, if you could kind of put us in the place and the space and the sensory experiences of your kind of cultural background and your the place where you came from, and just how life was for you then, to kind of get us grounded a little bit.
I was born in 1949 in Iowa, and we moved shortly thereafter to the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and then again, 2-3 years later, up to Bismarck, North Dakota. And I always say that it has two seasons, winter and the 4th of July. So that's what it's like to live in Bismarck, North Dakota. A lovely place, but snow's on the ground all the time. And I wear artificial legs and obviously artificial arms. So getting around was a little difficult, but it's actually so cold and the snow is so crunchy that it never got slippery, icy. So it was actually quite good place to get around. But I walked 4 blocks to school and back each day and with my sister, but it was just a normal childhood. It was incredibly normal. You know, only as I aged into the grades and through the grades did people start to point out to me, oh, you have a disability, or there's some, you're different, and I realized I couldn't keep up in baseball in the summertime. I was always thought I was going to be a pro baseball player, and I always practiced with my dad playing catch and batting and all that, and I kept thinking I'm going to be a pro baseball player, and he never popped my balloon. He never said no. And he said, if you work hard enough at it, you know, you might be able to do something in this area. Well, you know, I didn't quite make it, but had a wonderful experience doing it and ended up being student manager of baseball teams and basketball teams and things like that. So growing up in North Dakota is really a special experience. You know, the communities are very tight-knit and they take care of each other. And so everybody felt the responsibility for making sure that I was all right and I was safe. It's a place where you never lock your doors and you just, you know, went about your life. And if you misbehaved, my dad got a call very early, and when he knew before he got home, I knew he was going to walk in and ask me what was going on. So I had to really straighten up. I talk about just my dad because my mom died when I was very young. My mother died when I was 15 months old, and my little sister was 3 months old. And have a sister 4 years older, but my mother passed away of ovarian cancer that really wasn't discovered when my little sister was born in September, and by Thanksgiving she just was in so much pain and just couldn't understand what was going on, and they did some exploratory surgery and it was too late, and she died on December 31st of 1950. So my dad raised 3 of us kids, and he's just a visionary guy. He just never ever expected me to go off to a segregated place, a separate place. He knew that there were places available that would take me, but he also convinced the school district and the public school and then the Catholic school that was built to accept me for the way I am, and so he just made sure that it was all good. So I grew up kind of learning how to compete and get along and be accepted and figure out my own way with a lot of coaching from my dad. So that was the culture, you know, with family, very very Catholic, a lot of First Fridays, First Saturdays, a lot of Sunday masses, rosaries every night. I'm booked up. I've got credits, you know, like at least another 50 years of rosary credits, you know, in my life.
I do too, so I'm glad to hear that.
Okay.
You're speaking from one that also did that. Oh, that's beautiful. Your dad, we were talking on the, Mike and I were talking on the way up here, you know, I think we could take this whole conversation just as a parenting manifesto for anyone,
right.
You know, to see, what you've done in your life. And was there like a mantra? You kind of hinted at that a little bit. What was his, as you reflect back on it, you know, what was his way of parenting you?
It was pretty heavy-handed, so to speak, in firmness, not physically, but just a firmness about keeping up and fitting in. And this is before anything about reasonable accommodations and program modifications or anything like that to accommodate someone's limitations. That wasn't even talked about then. That wasn't part of the thinking at all. It wasn't even conceived. But my dad just expected me to do my best to keep up, and he kind of knew that I had ability in some areas, and he didn't push me into areas where he knew I wouldn't physically be able to keep up, but academically kind of knew I was, you know, when I wouldn't bring back the good grades, he would say, unacceptable, you know, just not appropriate. And he never tolerated any goofiness or inappropriate behavior or, you know, the lying thing. He just never ever accepted lying, ever, under any circumstance. No white lies, no lies, just no, never lying. So he treated all of us, our 3 kids, you know, my 2 sisters, the 3 of us, very much the same. My older sister was a wild child, and he had a heck of a time kind of reining her in, and my younger sister and I would watch this and sort of say, okay, we know where the boundaries are, we get it, you know. So, but he was really a loving man too, and really caring. So I have to say, as a parent, a single parent doing this, it's just remarkable. And the vision about where he could see me going in the future, remarkable. You know, I would ride in the car with him and he'd say, when you get out of college, it wasn't if I was going to college or if you get out of high school, when you get out of college, you might have to live near a barbershop because you may not be able to shave yourself. And so you might need to go to the barbershop and they'll shave you and maybe brush your hair for you in the morning. And you know, you're gonna have to learn how to take a shower, and you're gonna have to take care of yourself in the bathroom, and you're gonna have to be able to get your clothes on. And so everything had a purpose of independence. So he was always painting a picture down the road quite a ways that is very important. I think most kids try to live up to the expectations of their parents. And if anything, my dad painted a picture for me to live up to.
So when you and through your career, when you encounter parents who are in a certain stage of their journey, do you find yourself falling back to that same code of conduct, that advice that you were given, the vision that he set for you with them, mm-hmm. I mean, to help them through what must be a trying time for many of them when you encounter them?
Absolutely right. I fall back on that frequently, and I should look to you, right?
Yeah. Okay.
I look back on that, and I talk to parents about we have the right to succeed, and we also have the right to fail. And their kids with disabilities have to have the right to fail, but when they fail, they need to know that it's okay, that they've tried something and it didn't work, but that there are many other ways of going about the task at hand and to keep on trying and try a new direction. But always show the love, always show the respect, always show the support, give them ideas, but have very high expectations. And I think that's what we see in our parents at Henry Viscardi School. We see a lot of parents who have high expectations. Some come along who are protective and they're really scared and they just don't know how to model their behavior. They don't know who else, because they feel like they're all alone. And
right.
Really from the incidents, it's really low incidence population that we serve here. So very few people know each other. But when they come here, they get together through the Parent-Teacher Association and they start talking and they start realizing, oh, you did that and this is what I have. And I mean, these children are sick and very physically disabled. And so that combination, you know, you kind of like think, do I get tough with my kid who's goofing off and not doing their homework? Poor kids in a chair and got a trach and other things. Like, yeah, you got to get tough with them. You got to say, this is what I expect of you. You are capable of doing this, so you cannot cheat yourself on taking the easy way out. So I do fall back on my dad's advice.
Jump ahead to that a little bit, because in sort of doing a deep dive into some of the stories of the students here and of the people at the center that have been impacted, it really feels like you're helping to equip them with not just technical skills, but a real mindset, a real sort of mental and emotional resilience that, you know, I think on a couple levels is really interesting to tease out. You know, there's not any type of victimhood, and I think for any of us going through adversity or challenges in our lives, or for our children, you know, despite if they have a massive physical disability or just are struggling in another area of life as a regular-bodied person, or what, you know, can you talk about what that, you know, what that line is, where those edges are between nurturing and supporting, but also that firmness, and how, what's the philosophy with you and also at the school?
Right. It's a terrific point to make and an observation about how Dr. Viscardi really started the school. And I think I'm trying very hard to further his vision. And I think we all are. I think we all buy into the fact that Dr. Viscardi was a tough love kind of guy that had only the best interests of the children at heart, but also knew that they were capable of a lot more than society would even allow them to do, or even their families would allow them to do. So he was a guy that just didn't really accept no. The way he handled himself and the way he taught kids about hope and opportunity and then execution, getting a job, having dignity, respecting yourself, don't letting yourself down. Those are characteristics that are historic here at the Viscardi Center and school. So we build on those principles. And so when I go through the school, I'll talk to the kids and we'll chum up and we do a very light touch pass. But if I get time alone with them, and sometimes they'll come and visit me in my office, which is always a thrill, and they kind of come in and go, wow, this is really nice. I'm like, you could be the president and CEO of this someday. You know, and I'm telling them, seriously, you should think about something like this someday, all right? Get yourself ready. What's it going to take to get here? And, you know, they came to say hello, and it turns into sort of a back at you, you know? Help, just think about it a little bit. And so I try to encourage them to live a full life. School is one aspect. Friendships are very important. Family, essential. Good relationships, how do you structure good relationships with people, long-term trusting relationships, giving fairly of yourself and expecting other people to do the same. And then we think about, they go through different classrooms and each one of the teachers has a slightly different view of a relationship. So they're kind of like this is a mini community. I mean, there are any one time 700, 600 people in this building. 170 of them are students. But they're having a lot of touches and interactions with an awful lot of people. So how they manage those relationships become very important. You know, we think about and sometimes even talk about emotional intelligence that Dr. Daniel Goleman talked about, and how you read and understand people and how you have to establish a relationship that is a peer relationship with people. And of course there are authority figures like teachers and principals and people like that have to enforce things. But how the teacher talks to a child, a student here, and how the child responds to that authority and that educational moment is really important. So I talk to the teachers as much as I probably talk to the students about how they handle themselves with these kids. But they're so schooled themselves. They're so learned in the number of years, 20, 30 years of experience in these teachers and teaching assistants, that they understand sort of every child is different, and some people respond to harsh, quick, forceful commands, and other kids, you can't do that to them. They won't respond well to that. You have to pull them along and tap them and, you know, kind of direct them and lead them a little bit. So every person is different, and I think one of the things we try to do here is to make sure that they understand that as they go through life, just like this is a little bit of a community right here, they're going to go out into this world, and some people are not going to like them. Some people are going to treat them badly. How are you going to handle that? It's going to happen every day. How do you maintain your dignity about yourself? So those are the things that are kind of deep, but are really important for them to learn really early in life how to handle it. We don't want to take any joy away. We don't tell them, well, life is going to be tough and brutal. You know, they'll figure that out themselves, but we sort of let them evolve into it. But it's mostly about building up their self-esteem. And these kids, especially the young ones, love themselves and they love their friends. And it's really great to see.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it adds to the joy instead of taking it away by giving them those tools to interface with the world. It's such an empowering thing that they have control over how they see the world, no matter who treats them however. You know, I feel like that's a very joyful building block.
I think you're right. I think the joy comes from the fact that at some point in their life they have some control over who they are, how they respond, how they act. You know, friendships are two-way streets, and you've got to give a little to get a little. You know, you've got to be the one to sometimes reach out to other people. And so I think we do a good job here. Not just me, but everybody here really talks about building up their confidence and their self-esteem. And once they have that, they're going to be pretty well off for the rest of their lives.
You talked about Dr. Viscardi a little bit. I wanted to go back to the really special moment of, can, can you talk about your journey as, absolutely, as an East Yourselves child and ambassador, and how you met the circumstances around meeting Dr. Viscardi?
Well, the Dr. Viscardi story is just unbelievable. I was living in Bismarck, North Dakota, and with my dad and my two sisters, and I went to an Easter Seals camp for 6 weeks, a residential camp, which then qualified me to be considered for a national poster child. Unbeknownst to me, I was nominated, I was interviewed, and chosen. And here's this little 9-year-old from North Dakota going to travel all over the country, and it turns out to Australia and other places. Just unbelievable. You know, to me, I just thought North Dakota was the world. I thought everything was always cold, and it snowed 9 months of the year, and that's the way life was. It was, and never knew there were palm trees and summer and things like that that lasted long. So they picked me. I go to Chicago, where Easter Seals is headquartered, at the Palmer House. They have a kickoff luncheon. Dr. Viscardi is the speaker. I don't know him from anybody, you know. So I'm sitting in the audience with my dad, and he's just getting wound up, and he's getting hotter and hotter and fiery and just forceful and outraged at the poor treatment that people with disabilities are getting, and somebody slips him a note and says, "You're going on too long, you gotta stop, time to wrap it up." So he takes the note and he holds it up to the audience and he says, "They want me to stop, do you?" And everybody was like, no. So he takes the note and he tears it into little pieces of paper and throws it. And it's just like drama. I mean, big time drama. I'm just there to like be introduced to him. I'm seeing this whole show by this guy named Dr. Viscardi. And so he's really speaking truth. He's really talking about the quality of life and the poor quality of life that people have. So my dad at some point puts his arm around me and he says, "You can be like him someday." All right, so I'm looking at him and I'm thinking, gosh, you know, I don't know how that's ever gonna happen, but that's interesting. And I just was pretty enamored with Dr. Viscardi. That ends, I get introduced, blah, blah, I travel, do my Easter Seal thing, which is, I still love the organization and respect it immensely. But I run into Dr. Viscardi when I'm in my late 20s, I'm finished law school, he's the head of the White House Conference on Handicapped Individuals. That was what it was called in the mid-70s. And he's the chair of it. And I'm one of the five categorical sub-chairs. And I'm this young attorney. And we talk, and I said, "I met you when I was 9 years old, and you were very influential in my life and to my family." He sent my dad all his books. My dad read all his books. So he was we were very familiar with Dr. Viscardi, you know. So then we met again. And so he sort of took me under his wing. And then the other ironic touch point was that my best friend that I met on the speaking tour as we're going around the country in our late 20s and we're young lawyers with disabilities talking about the new civil rights laws was a guy named Paul Hearn. And Paul was a graduate of the Viscardi School. And then he went on to Hofstra Law School, honorary doctorate of laws, just an amazing guy. So he and I became fast friends. And we always would bump into each other and we'd plan to meet each other at these various conferences and drink beer together and tell stories. He had a lot more stories than I ever had. And so it was just another touch point, and we talked about Viscardi himself. But we came back together again. I came back together again with Dr. Viscardi later on, and we always were stayed friends. And I came here and spoke one time at the center. And so it was just a remarkable, long-standing relationship. To be the fourth president and CEO of this beautiful place is just one of the highest honors of my life.
About the evolution of the movement. As you mentioned, the former handicapped rights, the former name to the disability rights movement. You know, and you've talked in some of your previous interviews about how the public view of folks with disabilities was sort of a charity and pity, and you waited for what was given to you. Like the long view in your lifetime, and you've been involved since you were a child. Mm-hmm. what's been the arc of that mm-hmm. evolution, and what do you see as you look back over that long view of time?
I like the term arc of life, because I think in my 68 years of living, we have gone from a charity model and very little governmental support, other than some vocational support that started after World War I, and then some medical supports to allow poor people to have some access to fundamental services, but nothing like what Medicaid is today, to a point where we now have a social minority model as opposed to a charity model. And it really says who has a handicap and who has a disability at its core. And I have a disability, and people who don't accept me for being an equal, if it's environmental, if it's curbs without curb cuts, those are handicaps to me. But at its very core, it's how do we ensure that people with disabilities have an equal opportunity to participate fully in all aspects of society. And so I've seen this transition, and in the last probably 5 to 10 years, I see so much media attention focused on living life with a disability. A little bit of it is a little outrageous, but you know, and sensational. But for the most part, they're doing a really good job now of characterizing what living with a disability is all about. And it's educational and informative. And people are starting to get the fact that what's missing in this room? Who's not here? Who's not included? You know, something's missing. You know, what are we doing wrong here? Where's somebody with a disability? We're not addressing their needs. So from the built environment now to the virtual environment, we talk about the accessibility in a much broader way. Mm-hmm. We consider people who are aging with a disability and into disability as a very big part of the disability rights movement. So our age span and our arc of our movement is really kind of keeping up with the changes that have come about, the longer people living longer and aging into disability, the need to age in place, and the dignity and respect that goes with that, and then helping families and caregivers understand how important it is to honor the people that they're helping. There's a way of offering help, even to a child, but also to a senior, that we read people really quickly. It is part of our EQ, our emotional intelligence, or our, you know, and understanding where people are coming from, and even tone of voice or body language. We're reading all the signals, the verbal and nonverbal signals that people are giving to us. So caregivers have a big responsibility to honor the people that they're serving. So I've seen a tremendous amount of change, and the more we asked for our civil rights, the more we found battles in Congress over funding. Oh, how come you guys cost so much money? Good, I can't believe you guys cost so much money. Well, take away a couple of wars and maybe we'd have something for some people here, you know? It's not the first answer that should be, let's go to war. Let's get the military-industrial complex fired up. Not to be political about this, but I'm just saying, my people with disabilities who represent 55 to 60 million people in this country, a huge number, really are not yet fully there. And some of it is money and resources to allow them to have equal access. But other parts of it are really attitudinal and traditional. So we're working on all sides of the issue to improve life. So I have seen this whole transition over my lifetime.
You know, I want to talk about, I hadn't thought about the emotional sensitivity, and so it's a good question to talk about. You're a strong advocate for inclusion in the workplace and mm-hmm. in all of our major institutions. Mm-hmm. Can you help us understand a little bit more about the unique gifts? Obviously, you can't generalize, but what are some of the facets of the disabled population that people don't realize mm-hmm. the unique contributions that they can bring and make?
We're really great problem solvers. If companies are looking for problem solvers, we're great. You know, I put coins in my pocket, I get on the highway, I don't have my easy pass with me, How am I going to get the coins out of my pocket? I'm pulling off the side of the road a mile before the stop where I'm going to have to throw coins into a bucket, and I'm thinking, why did I put them there? You know, why, I got to think further ahead. I've got to solve my problems. And so if a company, this is what we do all day long. How am I going to do something and do it as fast as other people can do it who don't have disabilities, but do it a different way and do it my way?
So the thing that I was struck by in talking with you are sort of the twin ideas of the need for patience as somebody with a disability to be able to stay in the moment, to be able to accomplish what needs to be done, that problem-solving gene almost, alongside the need for planning things that able-bodied people don't have to even consider. Can you talk a little bit about how that's worked in your own life and even maybe what you see with the children in their development?
Patience is a virtue. And in this high-speed world that we're in of little sound bites and 15-second spots and all the rest, it's conflicting with our physical ability to be able to articulate what our wishes are sometimes, or what our physical capabilities are. I see so many people who have language or communication related disabilities and the difficulty that they have in having people wait to hear them out. And they're using augmentative communication devices, you know, that come in a variety of forms and are really continually improving, but still it takes time. And a lot of time when people are speaking with a child with a disability or a person who has a communication-related disability, they get impatient and they try to answer the question for that individual. They try to anticipate what that person's saying. And it takes a lot of patience on both people's parts not to come unglued and to try to keep it cool. We have a lot of kids here who really have learned and are learning how to handle that kind of exchange of ideas back and forth. And sometimes it's just totally frustrating to them. And they learn compensatory behaviors. They learn little sound bites that can get them by. I have a very good friend who grew up in New York who ended up as senior vice president of Wells Fargo, in charge of all of their technology, uses a wheelchair, severe cerebral palsy, refuses to use an augmentative communication device, is difficult to understand, but he basically says, if you don't understand me and work in understanding what I'm saying, it's your problem. And here you got an SVP of a major corporation who's just recently retired, who is taking this position. And it's kind of like, it's your problem. You know, he is so brilliant. So he can type out things, but he likes to verbalize. Our kids have the same challenges, and they're going through these same kinds of difficulties as how do I say a lot in a little? Anybody that writes or speaks often to a group realizes that it's so hard to say a lot with a few words. And this is what the challenge is for people with communication-related disabilities. And then there's the transference of an assumption that they're not as smart as. They just don't have the intellectual capabilities that other people might have. So they're already assumed to be less than. So it's very challenging. Then you take that fast forward to an aging population, someone who's had a stroke, who has had difficulty speaking, and they're learning themselves how to deal with limited speech, or they just can't find that word. You see them searching for that word, and the word won't come out, and they just can't get it. And so is the listener going to give them the respect and the time to let them find that word? You know, this is what we live with. So I think society is becoming more tolerant as the numbers of people with disabilities continue to expand and we are getting more out into the world. And I know it's a lot for the public to handle. You know, what is all this? I work with airlines at times and you know, help them, advise them on how to transport people with disabilities. And we have the service animal issue where everybody's bringing Fido, their favorite dog, you know, to go with them. And now we have peacocks and, and kangaroo, baby kangaroos wrapped in blankets. And, you know, you just get this abuse going on. But people are just out there more. So I think we're imposing ourselves a lot on society. But, you know, for a long time, we haven't been out. So I'd say patience goes both ways. We have to be patient in the way we express ourselves and get and say what we want to say as quickly as we can, and as cogently as we can. But we also expect people to hear us out. Calm down, listen to me.
And it's that, you know, speaking of emotional intelligence, it's that core of all of the branches of emotional intelligence is the ability to listen. And you're building that within your students, but you're also helping them project that skill out to the people that they communicate with, right?
Like absolutely.
Observing the patience that it takes for one of your students to be able to get through that moment to be understood is that's a really powerful transference, you know, in a lot of ways.
Right. And sometimes you never win. You never win somebody over. You never get them to give in on their bias, and it's so frustrating. Mm-hmm. I went to Georgetown University in my freshman year. It was a lot of walking. I don't walk well for long distances, but I didn't have a scooter at the time, and so I was walking everywhere and carrying books, and it was just like, God, what a workout before I got to the classroom, you know? So I'd get to this freshman English classroom, and this professor says to me in front of 30 other kids, people like you with disabilities don't belong in this college. And I was just like, are you kidding me? I said, I do too, you know? Yes, I do. And I ended up going to the dean of students and saying, I just got treated just like really badly, and I'm not a crybaby, and my dad's taught me to figure out how to win this person over. I could never win this guy over. I did well in school, especially that year, except he gave me a terrible grade, and all I could think of, it was just pure bias that I could not change this guy. I could not win him over. So we can't win everybody over. As much as, you know, we charm, and we laugh, and we never allow ourselves to be the subject of, you know, humor that is derogatory towards us, self-deprecating. Cannot do that. But we use humor in a very effective way to bridge conversations and create empathy and the like, but you know, you never use humor. I couldn't win this guy over no matter what I did. And I said, you know, and I was talking to my dad about it, and he said, welcome to this world, you know? You're gonna meet people like this all the time. And I said, really? You know, I've had a sheltered life, much like these kids here, have a wonderful life, and this is a school that love built, and they're gonna go out there and people aren't gonna be nice to them all the time. And it's like, they gotta get tough. They gotta be able to handle this.
We touched a little bit on the confluence of ageism and the Encore movement and the disability rights movement, how there's a real, but I wondered if you could dive in a little bit more regarding, you know, obviously what, you know, there's a benefit to the disabled population to be fully participative in society, but what's the benefit to society, what does society have, there's real needs there still, but what, you know, What are we missing by not getting this right? And what can we benefit from by getting it more right?
Hmm. We're one of the few cultures in this world that doesn't really honor its older folks. And I am really sort of amazed that as we pride ourselves on our diversity and our inclusion, that we really don't treat older people with a lot of respect. You know, there just is this assumption that they're losing it. They don't have it. They ain't got the juice, you know? Can't remember anything. Like, really? Maybe they're just so loaded with information that they can't remember it all. I find it to be unfortunate and sad because I think we're missing out on a great deal of the history of how we got to where we are and where we might go in this world, and the fact that people are aging longer and living in their homes and living in their communities only enhances, I think, everyone's quality of life. I do think in the area of employment that we have been neglectful of people with disabilities, and especially people who age into disability. Only 17% of us started our lives with our disabilities. That's me. 83% of people with disabilities in this country acquired their disability after birth. So it's the car accidents, it's the strokes, it's the head injuries, it's the amputations, it's diabetes, it's you name it. It comes on many times well into life, and yet people have obtained education, they've worked for a while, and all of a sudden they're sidelined, and they're put off to the side and not considered as part of a credible employee that could actually benefit a company. I think the smart employers today are looking at shared employment, shared jobs, part-time employment, and also just people who have a great deal to offer them and are willing to bring their wisdom to them. And so who pays for all that dependency is one economic argument. And the other is, what do you do to humanity if people with disabilities who are continually overlooked for positions, whether they be 16 or 66, you know, you're pushing them off and you're making them feel inadequate and substandard. Not true.
And the toll that takes.
The toll it takes is terrible. Right. Culturally, it just tears down. Right, and perpetuates itself after a while. You know, you watch, you see, then you think, oh, that must be the norm. As a kid growing up, that must be the norm. That's how you talk to, and that's how you treat people with disabilities. In other cultures, people who have aged into a certain category have a role of wisdom, and people come to them for advice and thought. That same wisdom is still there. It can be brought into the workplace. But I'd like to see us put into a role, and more often than not, of a mentor to our students with disabilities, and having mentors with disabilities mentor students with disabilities. How do you get through this stuff? How do you make this happen? How do you deal with it? When somebody says something terrible to you, how do you handle it? So, you know, my dad would help me when I was young, but I think we owe it to our movement, we owe it to younger people with disabilities to help them get through some of those challenging times. Now we've got 3 and maybe 4 generations in the workplace, so that it's quite possible that there could be an awful lot of information sharing. I just could see a gap missing in that we weren't honoring and recognizing people with disabilities who had really achieved a great deal and contributed to improving the quality of life of people in their countries and in their communities. And so we created the Henry Viscardi Achievement Awards to recognize individuals globally. And we get lots of nominations from incredible people. And this past year, 5 of the 10 people came from outside of the United States, which is just great. And they're of all ages. We have veterans with disabilities. We have doctors from India, we have people from Pakistan who are just changing the world in accessible information and communication technologies. But people are doing good things, and there really aren't enough awards and recognitions to be able to shine the light on them. So we decided that was our responsibility, our duty to do that.
And similarly, what about the young people? Do you have any stories or have you heard specific anecdotes from the youth that you are involved with about what it means to them to have those role models lifted up or to have a mentor involved in their life?
We try very hard to bring back either graduates or outstanding individuals with disabilities who are friends of mine. If they're going to be in New York, come by, address the student body. We had another fellow who had graduated from our school, went to law school, graduated from law school, married one of our teachers, and ran for elected office 3 times, lost the first 2 times, and won his 3rd time. He's a wheelchair user, severely disabled, and is now a judge for the 2nd District in Nassau County on Long Island. He has a 6-year term. He's become a politico. It's all he does is think and talk about politics. It's all, you know, disability really doesn't play into it much at all. He has some accommodations, they redesigned the courtroom for him, but he's really a smart guy. And every day, a lot of people without disabilities are going before a judge in a chair and getting their comeuppance for whatever they did or didn't do. So it's kind of a nice position to see a judge. And his swearing in was reenacted here on our stage so all the students could participate. It would be very difficult for him to, or for our students to be able to go see him being sworn in. So they brought the swearing in ceremony with the chief judge to the school, and they reenacted it for our students. And it was high pomp and circumstance. It was very dignified, lots of black robes and very honorable, and they realized this is a big deal. So these images, these messages are very powerful to our students, and I think they all see themselves lifted up, and their vision, their horizons are extended, I think, by the fact that they're exposed more and more to older people with disabilities who have gone through something similar to them, or maybe not even similar to them, but they've made it. So that's the contribution that I think intergenerational knowledge and transfer of information goes.
Can you give any practical advice for somebody who is interacting maybe with somebody they hadn't met before who has a disability? You know, it's easy to say, just be yourself, right? Right? Which we would all love to be able to do, but we know that that's not in reality kind of how it works mentally going into a situation like that. So can you give some advice on how you would hope, or maybe even a vision of people who do it well, you know, interacting with the children perhaps, mm-hmm. of how to interact, mm-hmm. you know, physically, body language mm-hmm. wise, self-awareness wise? Mm-hmm.
You know, kids are usually looking up at adults. And as we age and are still using wheelchairs, we're still looking up at people. And there are some power politics in body language that really people take advantage of. So if you're going to talk to somebody for a long period of time, it is better to get down on the level of the person if you can. Sit down in a chair and have a nice conversation if you can. Get eye to eye, so to speak. And if somebody's getting assistance from a third party, this is usually what happens. The person that's interacting with the individual with a disability will shift their discussion to the attendant and not continue to focus on the individual. Deaf people feel this all the time. And so you're talking to a deaf person, but the interpreter is speaking for the individual. And so your tendency is to talk to the person who's talking for them. And you've got to stay with the individual who is deaf and talking to you while the interpreter is speaking. So it's kind of just learning a few tricks, but also once you learn those true feelings and true behaviors, then stick with them and don't deviate from them. And then the patience thing, I've got to say, I'm so happy that we are talking about patience, is just respecting people enough to give them the time to get something done, get something out, handle something. And then when do you offer help and when do you not offer help? Oh, that's just a huge issue. I didn't know if you needed help, so I didn't say anything. That's often what I hear. I just didn't know whether it would be offensive if I offered you help. I'm like, you can offer me help all the time. And if I can do it myself, I'll say thank you so much for respecting me and I thank you for the offer, but I've got it. Or yes, you can help me get this out of my shirt pocket.
Kind of, again, going back to like the long expanse of your personal journey, you know, now that you're here at the center after, you know, following in the footsteps of your role model, can you just talk about what that's meant to you? Any kind of final words personally from your own journey
I think what Dr. Viscardi taught me was that you can chase your dreams and you can follow your heart and it will take you in a lot of great places. You can have a full, well-rounded life. You can have a family. You can have, he was a sailor. He hooked rugs. Everything he did well. He wrote 6-7 books. I'm a sloth compared to him. He was like such an overachiever. He was just incredible. 14 honorary degrees from colleges. I'm just on and on and on. Recognized as an advisor to 8 presidents. Hard act to follow, tough act to follow, but also one that taught me that I can have a full and great life. I can really do something with my life, and I really appreciate the fact that he paved the way for so many people to have good lives, full, complete lives. That's the best thing, I think, that Dr. Viscardi did. He was a tremendous role model, and he was a powerful force in the community, so people really knew who he was, that he had a disability, and that he really was leading a movement.
To learn more about John Kemp's life, the extraordinary legacy of Dr. Henry Viscardi, and for more stories from the Viscardi School and Center, go to henryviscardischool.org. And to learn more about encore.org and their transformative movement to create intergenerational partnerships in communities like yours, go to generation2generation.org. And there are links to all of these on our website and on 3-Minute Storyteller's Facebook page. Thanks so much for joining us in conversation with John Kemp. I'm so glad you're along for this ride.